live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, plans to turn Route 17 into Interstate 86 are moving forward, but not everyone's on board. Coming up, news editor Liam Mayo from the River Reporter breaks down what the state is planning and why some local advocates are pushing back and what it all means for the future of transportation in the Catskills. Flooding has hit New York hard this summer, and experts say it's only getting worse. Radio Catskill's Genevieve Hartnett speaks with Sullivan County historian John Conway, who says that to understand what's happening now, we need to look to the past. And this summer, young leaders are making a difference across Sullivan County. Coming up next, we'll talk to two members of Sullivan 180's internship program about what they've learned and what they're doing to shape the future of their towns, plus science stories with Joe Johnson and a pickle party at Sullivan Public right after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Texas officials have ordered civil arrest warrants for Texas Democratic lawmakers who have fled the state. They're trying to force the Democratic lawmakers to return and take up a GOP redistricting package. The plan is to redraw congressional districts in hopes of sending five more Republicans to the U.S. Congress. California Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom says if Texas Republicans succeed, California will move to redraw its congressional districts to favor Democrats.
Whatever they are doing will be neutered here in the state of California, and they will pay that price.
New York Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul is thinking the same thing. If the Texas plan moves forward, she says she will consider redrawing New York congressional districts to favor Democrats. An Arkansas judge says that a law mandating that the Ten Commandments be posted in certain public spaces is unconstitutional. Little Rock Public Radio's Josie Lenora has more.
Act 573 requires a copy of the Ten Commandments be hung in all public schools and buildings. Monday evening, Judge Timothy Brooks of the Western District blocked the law. His ruling called the mandate, quote, exclusionary, and said it usurps the rights of people who practice other faiths. The suit was brought by the ACLU of Arkansas. They represented several plaintiffs who were non-Protestant or non-religious. Supporters of the legislation said the signs will stand as a public value statement. Arkansas Attorney General Tim Griffin says he's considering his options for next steps. For NPR News, I'm Josie Lenora.
Israeli officials say they will start allowing some local merchants in Gaza to start dispensing aid. That would include baby food, produce, and hygiene supplies. The Israeli officials say the local merchants would have to be approved by the, quote, defense establishment. It's not clear who the merchants would be. Israel has been criticized for blocking most aid from reaching the enclave. Stocks open mixed this morning as Caterpillar blames tariffs for a disappointing earnings report. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped about 50 points in early trading.
Caterpillar is one of the stocks in the Dow Index. The heavy equipment maker says President Trump's tariffs have increased manufacturing cost. Caterpillar's quarterly operating profit was down 18% from a year ago. It's a good time to be in the software business, though. Palantir Technologies, which sells AI software, reported more than $1 billion in quarterly revenue. Its stock has jumped about sevenfold in the last 12 months. Crude oil prices continue to slide after OPEC and friends announced plans to boost oil production next month. Retail gasoline prices in the U.S. are slightly higher in the last week, but down from this time last year. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down 50 points. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The Coast Guard has released its final report on the Titan submersible. The experimental craft imploded 2 years ago, killing all five people aboard. The report says the disaster was preventable. Investigators say the submersible, owned by the OceanGate company, didn't have a proper design, and the company's workplace culture was toxic. Yosemite is one of America's most popular national parks. The park needs extra help during warmer months when it gets most of its 4 million annual visitors. But this year, some of Yosemite's seasonal workers were asked to work without pay. Kiara Eisner from NPR's investigations team has more.
When Yosemite couldn't hire its seasonal workers on time, supervisors asked the prospective workers if they would volunteer for the park. Emails reviewed by NPR show they were told that if they volunteered, they could stay in the housing that was promised to them as seasonal workers for free. Workers said they estimate that more than 50 seasonal workers volunteered. Some told NPR they worked without pay for up to 6 weeks. Because many of them depend on their seasonal jobs for housing, some felt like the federal government took advantage of their situation. Although the workers NPR spoke with were onboarded in June, they have not yet been paid for the time they worked for no pay. Kiara Eisner, NPR News.
Today is the annual Dolly Parton Day in Nashville, Tennessee. And this year, the Guinness Book of World Records has declared the country music star an official icon. It points to Dolly Parton's numerous hits over a career spanning more than 60 years. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Well, you've probably driven it, Route 17, winding through the Hudson Valley and the Catskills, but big changes are coming to this familiar stretch of highway. The state is in the process of upgrading Route 17 to federal interstate standards as part of a long-running effort to rebrand it as I-86. Some of that work is already underway around Monticello, with even more proposals on the table, but not everyone is on board. While state officials tout improved travel and connectivity, local advocates are raising concerns about how these upgrades and the money behind them could affect the region's environment, economy, and quality of life. Today, we're joined by Liam Mayo, news editor of The River Reporter, who's been following this story for more. Liam, good morning.
Good morning, Tim.
Your latest piece lays out that detailed map of what's happening on Route 17. Can you give folks a quick overview of the plan to turn it into I-86, something that's been going on for decades?
Yeah, as you mentioned, this plan has been going on for a while. It's actually older than I am, oddly enough. That's neither here nor there. But the federal legislation that sort of is underpinning all of this comes from 1998. It was called the Transportation Equity Act for the 21st Century, and it designated Route 17 as a priority upgrade for inclusion in the national highway system. And Route 17 stretches kind of all the way from the very western end of New York into sort of a portion that I assume readers or listeners of Radio Catskill will be a little more familiar with, the portion in the Catskills and Orange County and around here. So the upgrade of Route 17 to I-86 involves construction work to make sure that road meets interstate standards. And over the past a couple of decades, a lot of that work has already taken place. As you mentioned, we have kind of a DOT map attached to our story on our website that that shows the work has already been done on most of the western end of the corridor. So I-86 currently stretches all the way from the western end of the state up to Binghamton. And it's the bit from Binghamton onwards that's still needs to be upgraded. And as you mentioned, there are a couple of local projects that are currently in the works to do just that. There is the project further into the Hudson Valley at the tail end of Route 17, stretching from exit 113 to exit 131. And this is a project that sort of takes that whole huge chunk of the highway. And while proposals are still kind of being worked out for what exactly it'll look like, one of the more likely ones is adding a third lane or expanding that stretch of highway. And this is a project that is expected to cost over $1 billion all told in investment into that highway. So that's one that's sort of currently in the design process, currently going through environmental review. There's also projects happening around Monticello that are a little bit less advanced. There are proposals to upgrade exits 103, 104, and 107 in Monticello. And those, NYSDOT is just kind of introducing to the public and just at the very early stages of getting public input from. So There was a public like display session last Monday, the 28th of July, where the New York State Department of Transportation had just very preliminary proposals for what exit 107 could look like, but those could still change as public input came in, and they weren't even at that stage for exits 103 and 104. It was entirely just an announcement that they were doing this and a call for public input. But these exit upgrades could look something kind of similar to what is currently in place for Monticello's exit 105, which was upgraded to this very fancy roundabout system a couple of years ago. And it was also part of this broader overall effort to upgrade upgrade Route 17 to I-86 standards.
Yeah. What do we know why this has taken so long? You mentioned that it started in 1998 with a federal grant there. And why is this section of the project moving forward now?
I assume that it's just that they've been working their way east from the western end of the state. I mean, if you look at the map, like, they are sort of over halfway done at this point. There's huge stretches of highway that have already been upgraded to I-86. And if they upgrade this this section sort of at the very tail end, the section from 113 to 131, that knocks out another huge chunk of it. So if that project sort of goes forward as proposed, by the end of the decade, we could see just only a very little left to do to upgrade the entire corridor. But, you know, transportation projects take a very long time, and this is a very sort of ambitious project. And a lot has happened in the past 30 years that could have, you know, delayed sections or made sections take longer than originally suggested.
You mentioned that public meeting last week. Those were from the folks that are behind the project. But then there are other folks like Catskill Mountain Keeper who have some concerns. What's their argument against expanding the highway, and how does the idea of, quote, induced demand fit into that?
Yeah. So there's a advocacy organization called the Catskill Mountain Keeper that sort of works to promote the health of the Catskill Mountains and the regional communities there. And they are anchoring this coalition, the Rethink Route 17 coalition, to try and get people to think about using this money a different way. And one of their main arguments is that over $1 billion of investment into the transportation of the Hudson Valley and the Catskills, you could spend that money a lot of other ways instead of just on Route 17 improvements. They say that, according to, and this is them quoting New York State Department of Transportation figures, I believe, they calculate that the entire project would shave about 3 minutes and 6 seconds off the estimated or off the average journey on Route 17, and that 95.8% of the time there is no congestion on Route 17. So this whole over $1 billion project would have very marginal improvements to the like average traveler's experience on Route 17. And then on the other hand, if you spend that money on other things, on more local things, you could get a much bigger bang for your buck. They mention, as a couple of the other options, fixing potholes throughout the area, or prioritizing improving sort of local roads that really need the work over this interstate highway. They mention investing into downtowns and small businesses and walkable sort of opportunities, and just offering more multimodal forms of transportation, like bus opportunities and trails and bikeways and things like that.
You mentioned that they were asking for public input at that meeting last week. How can folks get involved, and is there a timeline for that public input?
Yeah, I believe a lot of public input sort of on both projects is being sought over the next couple of months. And there are a couple of different websites to look for. The New York State Department of Transportation website is route17.dot.ny.gov. And that's somewhere that people can input public comment. There are also a couple of project emails that are very wordy. So I'll just mention that we include them on our website and say that there's, you could also send comments in by mail to 44 Holly Street, Binghamton, New York. And then the Catskill Mountain Keeper and the Rethink Route 17 Coalition are also kind of encouraging people to get involved and to weigh in their input. And information about that can be found at their coalition website, rethinkroute17.org. And that's with the number 17, not written out 17.
That's Liam Mayo. He's the news editor for The River Reporter. You can read his story, Competing Visions, presented for Route 17 Upgrades at riverreporter.com. And you can get all of those addresses there as well. They're like hashtags and backslashes. So yes, go to riverreporter.com to get that info if you want to learn more. Liam Mayo, thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, flooding is hitting the region hard. The Sullivan County historian says we need to look to our past to solve our future. We'll learn more after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
The White House asked Congress to pull back federal funding for public media that had already been approved, and Congress has gone along. We want you to know that NPR and this station remain committed to informing the public, increasing your understanding of the world, and hopefully enriching your life in other ways. But without federal funding, we're relying on your support now more than ever. Please make your gift to this station today. Here's how.
Give now at WJFFradio.org. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Flooding has been a major issue nationwide this summer, and New York has been no exception. From the flooding on the Sawmill River Parkway and the Cross Bronx Expressway in the city to the most recent flash flood warning for Orange County last week, Governor Kathy Hochul even declared a state of emergency for several counties in our region. The increase in severity and frequency of these hazardous floods is leading to many identifying the causes and urging our leaders to find solutions. Radio Catskill's Genevieve Hartnett spoke with Sullivan County historian John Conway about how to, in order to effectively address this problem, we need to look to our past.
This summer, we've already seen major flooding in New York. Is this degree of flooding common, or has it drastically increased in recent years?
I don't think you can find any sort of a linear progression in terms of the number or the intensity of floods. But throughout our history, we've had major floods. If we go back to the writing of John Willard Johnston, he chronicles some of the early floods dating back to the very early 19th century. And he makes it clear that in his opinion, the flooding was exacerbated by man-made activities such as cutting the timber. For the timber rafting industry, and then later for the tanning industry, and probably that has affected things. And there's always been this debate as to how much of an impact human activity has had, whether it's climate change, it's flooding, it's various other hurricanes. How much has human activity contributed, and how much of it is just nature? But Johnston made it clear that the severity of the floods, if not the frequency of them, was certainly exacerbated by human activity and specifically the cutting of the trees.
What is, would you say, is the most devastating flooding that Sullivan County has faced, whether it's throughout the 19th or 20th century or in recent memory?
People talk about the flood of 1955, I believe it was Hurricane came through, and I have very vague recollections about I was a toddler in 1955, but I do sort of remember some of it. I certainly have seen pictures. So the 55 flood is generally considered one of the worst, but I think the 2006 flood was pretty devastating. There have been other floods that didn't involve the Delaware. For example, I was reading recently about some major flood in August of 38 that damaged 7 bridges in the town of Liberty. And that was more of the Neversink and tributaries to the Neversink River. And then, of course, we can also talk about the summer of 1969 and the impact that the flooding had on the Woodstock Festival and, of course, the rains that came there. You know, floods have had significant impacts on our history throughout. Pretty much any decade you pick, you could find a flood that was impactful, I think.
It's possible to assume that because we're in the Catskills region, because we're in a particularly mountainous area, that flooding might not be an issue. What else would you say to just say that it's not something that should be overlooked in our region, the risk of flooding?
One of the lesser considered contributing factors is that as we continue to develop the land, as we pave over more and more of our surface area, and as we compact the soils to facilitate construction, we're contributing in many ways to flooding. And some of it is just a trade-off that we have to make if we're going to continue to facilitate the growth of our population. But I think we need to also be a little bit more cognizant of the consequences of what we do. For many years, generations really, mankind has sort of acted with this sense of impunity that, you know, we can do whatever we want to do. We have control over nature, and that we're the consequences can be handled. And I'm not so sure that's a wise way to proceed. I think we should have learned a long time ago that no matter how far we advance, we are to a certain extent always going to be at the mercy of Mother Nature, whether it's hurricanes or tornadoes, flooding, massive snowstorms. So there are just certain things that are beyond our control.
What do you think we should be doing at the state, at the county level or the state level to get ready as we go into the season where New York State faces the most flash flood warnings?
The challenge is always, and again, this is financially driven. You know, it all comes down to what kind of funding is available to do anything. But I think the county in general needs to be much more proactive in terms of dealing with not just the flooding issue, but pretty much every issue the county faces. I think historically, and I'm speaking as an historian, we have a track record of being very reactive and not being particularly proactive in dealing with issues here. And that, I think, is why we oftentimes find ourselves behind the eight ball. Yeah, flooding is the specific issue we're talking about today, but I think you could kind of fill in the blank with a number of other, whether it's transportation. There are a myriad issues that fall into this category where reactive measures are not nearly as effective as proactive measures could have been. You could go back to the date of the big hotels and the fact that we just never prepared ourselves the inevitable time when those hotels were going to fail, when they were going to no longer drive our economy. We just didn't see that coming or didn't want to see it coming. And so there was just a lack of foresight, a lack of proactive measures. And it's easy to look back and to criticize. And I hope it doesn't come across as that's what I'm doing, but I'm just saying we need to be to always be more proactive and less reactive to issues. And flooding, I think, is a perfect example. Get out in front of it. Let's prepare for the worst, because some years are going to be worse than others. We shouldn't be lulled into a sense of security just because we face a year or two where flooding is not a major issue. I'd just like to emphasize how important it is to learn from our history. And we look back at the history of flooding, it's a great example to see that, you know, this is not something that we're facing for the first time. This is not something that's going to go away. Flooding has been with us forever, and it's always going to be with us. And I think we can learn valuable lessons from our history, not just about flooding, but virtually in every issue that we are faced.
John, thank you very, very much for taking the time to speak with me today.
I thank you for giving me the opportunity, and I hope I was in some way you provided some insight that might be valuable.
In Liberty, I'm Genevieve Hartnett for Radio Catskill.
And we'll take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk with two members of the Sullivan 180 internship program about what they've learned, why it matters, and how youth are shaping the future of their towns. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, former Secretary of State Antony Blinken is not a flamethrower.
Maybe I'm not made for these times.
But he certainly has strong opinions on Israel, Gaza, China, Iran, Russia, Biden and Trump, and the rest of the world.
Left unattended, a problem halfway around the world easily comes and bites us.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. This afternoon at 1 o'clock on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new releases, film festivals, nostalgic screenings, live music events, and more. Information and schedule at thecalicoontheater.com.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. This summer, Sullivan 180's internship program has once again brought together young people from across the county to learn, lead, and lend a hand in their hometowns. This morning on Radio Chatskill, we're joined live by Sullivan 180 program assistant Cheslin Chezzy Hanafy and second-year intern Allie Galvin-Bliefernick. Chezzy and Allie, good morning. How are you guys?
Good morning. Good.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Chezzy, tell us a little bit more about the Sullivan 180 internship program. As the program assistant, I imagine you're well-versed in this.
Yeah, I like to hope so. I'll try to explain it as best as I can. But so Sullivan 180 is dedicated to creating a healthier Sullivan County with a focus on prevention. And a key part of that mission is investing in our youth because they really are the foundation of our communities. Our internship program provides a paid opportunity for individuals ages 16 to 20, and they go out in the community and work on projects to help beautify Sullivan County and better public spaces. And they work with supervisors who help mentor and guide them throughout the process. They also work with other community members and volunteers who really help network and support them with a shared purpose. So they also, in addition to that, have Wednesday intern sessions where they work on their professional skills, and they have a bunch of presenters who come in throughout the summer and help guide them on their hard and soft skills.
I want to ask you about those internship sessions, both of you. We've talked to you guys before at Sullivan 180 about the internship program. I think a lot of people that are familiar with the program are more familiar with the outward facing aspect of it. If you see younger folks in the community helping out with, you know, some of the beautification efforts. But these internship sessions are really key to what the whole experience is about. What kinds of things do you focus on? What things do you learn? How does that kind of carry over into real life? Allie, do you want to take that one?
So one of the things that I have definitely noticed and learned more about is leadership and interview skills are definitely the things they really instill in us. They have helped me over the last 2 years, especially with different experiences, with different job opportunities. I don't know. I think they've been really applicable skills. Like, again, leadership, they make sure that our voices are heard. That's something that I've always felt is really big. They actually listen to our voice. They actually listen to our input, and we seem very valued. Our actual input, our work, everything that we do seems very valued in our communities and to them as well.
Allie, you're a second-year intern.
Yes.
How is your experience this year built on what you learned last year?
I think definitely just the applicability of a lot of the skills, seeing the impact I have, seeing just like the little changes I make, how they impact the community, how they impact my life and others. That's definitely something that I've noticed. I've been working in the same community the last 2 years, and I've seen just the transformation of the gardens. And again, how that affects the community around me, how many more people are like, thank you so much for your work, and just how much of an impact I guess I have. That's something that's always been a big takeaway for me with this internship, is that I can really have an impact. I can really change.
And Chezzy, as the program assistant, you see these interns going through this. What has been the most rewarding part of watching their growth and impact?
Yeah, so I think from the beginning, everyone's a little awkward and shy. And for a lot of these interns, it's their first real job experience. So I feel that once they are in an environment, especially in these Wednesday intern sessions with individuals who let them know that their voices are heard and that they can open up, it's so fun to just see them really blossom and speak on issues that are so important to our community and give their opinions, especially because this is their home. So we want them to feel welcomed and invited to speak on behalf of themselves and their schools. And I'm just really proud of all the work and dedication they've put in over the time. So
I want to ask you both, what project or moment has had the biggest impact on you personally or made you especially proud of your work? Jessica, I'll start with you.
I would just say I don't see directly always hands-on what they're doing out in the community. I see a lot of them within their intern sessions. And I think, for example, having speakers like Chief Degatta, the conversation that they have and them.
Liberty Police Chief.
Yes, it's been fantastic seeing the interns open up and give their input on how they feel maybe some negative impacts they see in the community and how they would like to see that get better. And I think that just hearing their voices heard outside of even Sullivan 180 has just been fantastic. And that's part of really rewarding for me.
Yeah, is there a moment or experience you've had that's made the biggest impact on you this second summer?
Well, I was thinking more in terms of both summers. Uh-huh. I remember the first garden that I finished was like, wow, I can do this. I worked on the pollinator garden that's down in Berryville. It's in our cul-de-sac area. There's a little river input, and it's right between, it's a little off the road of these two really busy roads in a very community-centered area. And I remember after I finished that garden, after I'd weeded, after I'd mulched, after I'd edged the garden, after I did some deadheading, all the little things to make it beautiful, I just remember the impact I had and how many people said, like, this is, like, such a great thing that you're doing. And just the joy I had in myself for seeing, like, I can do this. I can. It's like I put in a lot of work. It's very hard. So much sweat. But I did something. I made it so much more beautiful.
Mm-hmm. So we were talking before we came on that we can't believe it's August and you guys are going on to new things. What's next for you, Allie? Are you going back to school?
Yeah, I'm going into my senior year. I'm doing a lot of training to get ready for soccer, hopefully. I'm a soccer goalie. So fingers crossed, I'll be able to play a lot this year. But yeah, I'm going to start applying for colleges soon. I'm really interested in fashion and I'm looking at FIT as my first choice.
And Chessie, you're moving into college.
Yeah, so I'm going to grad school in Boston. I'm really excited. I'm studying marketing and journalism. So I think that I'm so excited to leave and get out there. But also, I think this internship has given me a newfound appreciation for home. So it'll be hard to leave.
And before we go, over here, not saying too much today, Anne-Louise is our internship coordinator, director. You're in charge of the interns. Anything you want to say to Anne-Louise before we go?
I just want to thank you so much for this opportunity. Your support and guidance has meant the world with me, and I'll take it with me forever, seriously.
Yes, a lot of the lessons I've learned, especially through the internship meetings and what I'm capable of, that's something that has I've already applied, that I will definitely continue to apply, especially with applying for colleges.
All right. That is Chessie Hanafy and Allie Galvin-Bliefernick of Sullivan 180. They're in the internship program. There's much more about Sullivan 180 and the work they do at Sullivan180.org. Thank you all so much. And Anne-Louise, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
We should also mention that Sullivan 180 is a financial supporter of Radio Catskill. We'll take a break. And when we come back, science stories from our resident science guy, Joe Johnson, including, get this, spiders on Mars. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFRadio.org.
On the next Radio Lab,
you see these wasps?
Editor Alex Neeson slogs through dusty archives and swampy cemeteries.
Ooh, I'm stepping in mud.
To uncover,
where are you?
The dark history behind her name.
This is where it starts.
And figure out if your name is something you have to move past, or
Wait! What?
If it's your best way of moving forward.
You know, I'm right here. I'm moving forward.
That's on the next Radio Lab, Wednesday at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno.
And Joe Johnson is our resident science guy, scouring the skies for science stories that caught his interest. This week, we're talking about shorter days, including today, and how milliseconds are being shaved off the Earth's rotation, black rudder goo from a research vessel in the Great Lakes, and spiders on Mars.
Spiders from Mars, and no, not David Bowie's backup band. But yeah, this is a NASA press release from last year that was recently picked up in the news. And these are features on the surface of Mars that were first photographed from orbit back in the early 2000s. But recently, the Mars Express Orbiter back in 2024, which, by the way, is mapping the planet in amazing detail, photographed these large, dark, spider-like features up to about a half a mile across. And they had, you know, no kind of clue what they were. Now, they're found near the Martian South Pole in an area called Inca City. And I had to, if you look at a picture of Inca City, you're going to think there's ruins on Mars, because it's a geological feature that actually looks like ancient ruins. They think that there was an asteroid impact that shattered the surface, and then magma flowed up into these cracks and solidified. And then over eons, the wind erosion on Mars kind of eroded the softer material away, leaving these large, like, room-like features, but there would be hundreds and hundreds of yards, 2 miles across, so they're huge. But the spiders form, like, in and around these, and you got to remember what the conditions are like on Mars. We've got to give a little background for this. Mars is not a great place. It is very cold, like minus 225 degrees Fahrenheit. It has a 95% carbon dioxide atmosphere, and it's about 1% of Earth's air pressure. Okay, so it's a difficult place to live. Winters are brutal. They last about twice as long as Earth. And the southern hemisphere, where these spiders are seen, the southern hemisphere winter is especially brutal because of the elliptical orbit from Mars. When it's winter on Mars, Mars is actually farther away from the sun. So it's even colder than it would, you know, might normally be. Now, the theory goes like this. In winter, they think that the carbon dioxide gas in the atmosphere is deposited as a solid on the surface. It doesn't turn into a liquid. It turns directly from a gas into a solid. It's called deposition. And it's actually thought that it's going to decrease the global atmospheric pressure. There's so much carbon dioxide coming out of the atmosphere that air pressure, I don't want to say air, but gas pressure, goes down by like 25%. And the CO2 builds up on the surface as translucent carbon dioxide ice. I don't know if you've ever played with dry ice, but okay. It's kind of like clear, translucent. And that's the same material. Okay, light can pass through it. So in spring, the sun is going to shine through this ice when spring finally rolls around, and it's going to warm the darker Martian regolith, the surface underneath it, and the carbon dioxide ice closest to the surface is going to undergo sublimation. It's going to change directly from a solid back into a gas, build up gas pressure, and at the weakest spot, it actually blows through the surface and blows material out over the surface of Mars, and it forms these giant spider-like features.
The picture, they really do look like a bunch of spiders.
They do. They
but
do.
But there's nothing, there's no equivalent like this on Earth.
No.
And they haven't had a chance to really observe it in situation on Mars, because of how you describe Mars.
Well, nobody's
there
on Mars. Yes, but what they
did? What are they doing? Yeah.
Well, they did an experiment. This is what the press release was about last October. They did an experiment carried out in a Mars simulation chamber. It's a large chamber that they simulate the conditions on Mars, and they allowed CO2 to build up over a bed of sand similar to Mars. And once they got a certain thickness, they started warming it up. And what they found was that the CO2 shot out of the surface in these big plumes. So they've kind of got a proof of concept here, but we'll see what happens. You know, they'll eventually we'll be on Mars and we'll have people walking around, and we'll see if their theory is correct.
We'll send them to the spiders.
We'll send them to the spiders.
Go over there.
Yes.
Let's talk about shorter days. Apparently today, August 5th, one of the shortest days on record. I thought that
it's predicted to be the shortest.
Why is that?
Well, okay. So there's a number of articles in the popular press over the last couple of weeks regarding this minute change in the length of a day. And we are talking milliseconds here. You know, a day is 24 hours or 86,400 seconds long. That's what's called a sidereal day, by the way. Let's define what a day is. It's the time that it takes the Earth to make one complete rotation. And they measure that rotation against distant radio signals, like from a quasar, an extragalactic quasar, so they know exactly how long it takes the Earth to rotate. So the standard day is 24 hours or, like I said, 86,400 seconds long. Lately, there have been slight variations in this. July 9th was about 1.23 milliseconds. A millisecond is a thousandth of a second. Shorter than the standard day. July 10th, 1.36 milliseconds shorter. July 22nd, 1.34. And the 5th is predicted to be 1.25 milliseconds shorter. We'll see if that prediction comes correct. Measurement is really difficult to do. There's this giant coordinated network of atomic clocks and observatories and satellites that really precisely measure the rate of rotation of the Earth. And it's coordinated by an organization called, and this was new to me, the International Earth Rotation and Reference Systems Service, which monitors the rotation rate of the Earth. Now, the question is, why is this important? Why do we care if the day is, you know, 1.25 milliseconds shorter? Well, there's a lot of technology, especially like GPS, that relies on precision timekeeping. If time doesn't match between two clocks of technology trying to talk to each other, it can wreak havoc on what's going on. Qantas Airlines was 1 millisecond off in its clock one time, and it shut their whole system down. So it's pretty important stuff.
So when I hear things like mysterious and we're not really sure why, or a strange shift in the Earth's rotation,
well,
should I be concerned?
I don't think you should be concerned for a couple of reasons. One, the change is really, really minor. It's a tiny percent. You think about 1 in 86 million change, one part in 86 million. The long-term trend actually is for days to become slightly longer, because as the moon pulls away from us a few centimeters per year, it actually slows the Earth down a little bit. And clocks can be adjusted. Coordinated universal time can be adjusted. In fact, they've added 27 leap seconds to universal time since 1972.
So we're not going to notice this change in the rotation today.
We are not. Now, the question is, why is the day length changing? You know, and there's a couple of reasons for this. First of all, you know, any movement of mass or force acting on the Earth. So the moon position and tides changes the rate of the Earth. Atmospheric changes. Movement of liquid in the outer core actually can change the distribution of mass on the surface. Filling or emptying large reservoirs. Melting of ice caps looks to be a really important change, because you're taking ice and you're turning it into water, and it's changing its mass. You can actually kind of demonstrate this for yourself. It's kind of a fun little demonstration. If you've got a spinny chair, you know, a chair that spins around, okay, spin yourself around, or have somebody spin you around with your arms and legs out, and then quickly draw them in. And what's going to happen is you're going to speed up. It's almost like an ice skater. I don't know if you've seen an ice skater doing a pirouette, and they pull their arms in and they go faster and faster. Yeah, yeah. It's kind of the same idea. The little bit of change in the position of mass can have a big effect on the rate of spin.
I am sitting in a spinning chair right now, but I will have the headphones on and crash into the mic, so I won't do my camel right now.
We'll try it later.
Let's do it later. Let's talk about the other story you have here about a research vessel, the Blue Heron, in the Great Lakes. It's a research vessel that's gathering data from the water of the Great Lakes, but then it gathered some data from its own rudder.
Yeah, absolutely. This kind of proves that scientists can be kind of look in weird places for their data. This is a June 27th press release from the University of Minnesota at Duluth. And yes, the research vessel Blue Heron, it was operating in Lake Erie last fall studying algal blooms, harmful algal blooms. And it developed a vibration in its propeller shaft, so they had to put it in dry dock. And while it was in dry dock, the captain was walking around underneath it, and he looked up at the rudder housing, and there was this black goo oozing out of the housing. And this is an area that's not greased, because it's in direct contact with the water, and it would pollute the water, and so they don't grease it. They said that they actually used the water to lubricate it. But this kind of piqued his interest. So he gathered a sample and he showed it to a chemist friend of his. And the chemist said, well, let's think what it might be. It might be oil. So they tried to burn it and it would not burn. They put it in water to see, you know, if you put oil in water, it spreads a sheen on the water, and it did not spread a sheen. Also, it felt very slimy, not greasy. So they said, well, we work for a university. Let's send this off to some microbiologists who were, by the way, flummoxed by this. This is an oxygen-free, very warm environment. And so it's not that friendly to life, you know, especially being oxygen-free. It contained about 20 different genomes of microorganisms. Most matched, you know, known organisms. There's a worldwide database that they can compare it to. And they said most of them fit these, you know, previously known organisms. Several was what they identified, what they described rather as less identifiable. But they thought that they were related to organisms that they had seen in tar pits in oil wells. One was completely new to science, and they tentatively named it Ship Goo 001. Once again, scientists do have a sense of
clever
humor.
Name.
Yeah, they'll come up with a final name eventually, but it'll have to follow some rules. Now, this unknown organism is really exciting because it's an archaean organism. It's a prokaryote. It's not a eukaryote. In other words, it doesn't have a cell. It doesn't have a nuclear membrane. It doesn't have complex cell structures. It's a very simple organism, and it represents a new bacterial phylum, not a genus or a species, but a phylum. And if you remember from science, kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. That's the way we classify organisms. So it's just under kingdom. And so it's a whole new branch of the Monerans kingdom.
Is that unusual?
You do not find new phyla very often at all. And so, this is pretty interesting. Now, there's been no scientific paper yet, and I'll be waiting to read that paper when it comes out, because some of the articles I read, they play a little fast and loose with the language sometimes. So I want the scientific article. Now, the question I have is, where did this organism come from? Because if you think about it, this ship has been in the Great Lakes. I guess it's been in several of the Great Lakes, but that's a very oxygenated environment. And this is something that thrives in no oxygen. And so how did it get there? How did it survive? How does it, you know, it's very, very interesting stuff. They have not seen the organism itself. They have only detected its DNA. So I'm sure they're going to be doing more research.
Yeah. I mean, how did it hitch a ride on the rudder of a boat in
exactly.
the Great Lakes?
Exactly.
You know what I hope they don't find in that scientific paper?
What's that?
That those Mars spiders had anything to do with it. Then I'll really be concerned.
Me too.
Joe Johnson, Science Stories. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, sir.
We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, a pickle party this weekend. We'll learn more. This is Radio Chatskill.
When you walk into NPR headquarters, one of the first things you see is a big map of the country covered with little blue dots. Each dot represents a local public radio station. That's the NPR network. I'm Catherine Marr, CEO of NPR. With federal funding for public media eliminated, your network is under serious threat. Help us plan for the road ahead by giving to this station today. Thank you.
Give now at wjffradio.org.
Hi, I'm Bill Williams. Join me for the Kingfisher Project tonight, when my guest will be Camille O'Brien, Crisis Services Coordinator for the Department of Community Services for Sullivan County.
There's a lot of on-the-ground work to be had, and we're just trying to figure out how to make it happen. These are new services in Sullivan County. They're newer services in the world of mental health and substance use.
That's the Kingfisher Project tonight at 6 on the local edition, only on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Get ready to dill with some serious fun because pickles are taking over. Jessie Lazar from Sullivan Public is here to tell us about the Public Pickle Party, which is happening Sunday, August 10th, where there'll be brine, bites, and a science show. It's part food fest, part garden swap, and all small town joy. Jessie, hi.
Hi, Tim.
Tell us about this Public Pickle Party. Where did this idea come from?
So there's this lovely guy, Austin Nash, who, I don't know, it was snowing out, came to me and said, hey, do you ever do anything with pickling? And both of us looked at each other. We were like, nope. So now we got to do that. And we have these monthly Second Sunday events every summer, every second Sunday of every month. And it just seemed like a perfect community event to have Austin come and help guide a pickling demo and then have a big community party.
And when people show up, let's talk about the experience here. I mentioned there's a couple different things going on, from the garden swap to the demos to the science show. So what can folks expect when they show up on Sunday?
So the public pickle party part of it, lots of alliteration there, is from 12 to 2. Austin is making a couple different brines, I think. And people are just encouraged to share what they've been doing in their backyard. It's that time of year where all of the bounty of our gardens are sort of spilling over. And we're hoping that you bring string beans and I bring carrots and there's radishes and people come and share the beautiful things that their gardens are producing.
I wanted to ask you about that. Why is it important to bring that community exchange element to this for you?
You know, I think that celebrating where we are, the nature that we're in, the ability to grow stuff here, it's often a very private thing to have a garden in your home. And so I think this is just such an inclusive, I mean, it's great for little kids and for seasoned adults. If somebody wants to come with like their family recipe of, you know, spices and herbs, it's a really lovely way to share, swap, and have like a community celebration of the nature here that we're all sort of harvesting in our backyards right now. I also want to mention, if you don't have a garden, you can also come and there'll be local farm. Austin works with Hidden Acre Farms, which is, you know, they're on the farmer market circuit. And they're going to come and have beautiful vegetables that you can also come and purchase at cost. We'll have jars. Please clean out your pantries and bring your old jars. But also, if you don't have those things, you can still come and be part of this.
I know that the elements of pickling are relatively simple, but for some, me included, pickling sounds, it's intimidating in some ways. So I don't know why I'm intimidated by this. But how is this for beginners? What do you advise and will they actually make something and take it away?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, there's going to be giant lobster pots of brine. And I think that that's kind of the tricky part is the recipe. So there's going to be something, I think he's making something sweet, like a bread and butter sort of flavor, and then sour, like a more traditional dill pickle. And you just slice up veggies, shove them in a jar, and then the magic is in the brine.
Right.
So you kind of can't go wrong because Austin's a pro. So he's going to come. He's going to help you guide you 12 to 2 with your neighbor's garden, with local farmers' produce, your own produce. And yeah, and then you'll have this beautiful memento to take with you and like – it's a flavor that keeps for a while, so you can stick these in your fridge and enjoy them once it's cool.
Overcome your pickle.
Yeah.
Fears.
There's no pickle paranoia for you, Tim.
You've got some local chefs involved, too, and even a pickle-forward sushi vendor.
Yeah. So in Sullivan Public, second Sunday, more alliteration, in our second Sunday blowout community, we want this to not just be a 10-minute pickling thing, but a stay and talk to your neighbors and meet new people and let the kids play. So, yeah, we've got Yaparai is an amazing sushi maker. They have restaurants in the city. They've done a lot of work with Sullivan Public in the past, and they're going to be there with pickle-forward sushi. So they'll have regular sushi, but they're also have chefs that are going to make some beautiful pickles that are going to be incorporated. And we have Pam's Jams, who's going to have relish and pickles that she generally makes beautiful sweet things, but she's bringing some more savory. And the Beeb and Bus is going to be selling kimchi, but then there's vintage clothing vendors that are coming. And we're going to have – you can get pickled with four grill ciders coming with hard cider. And yeah, and then the final sort of – well, there's other things too. But then the final exciting thing is the science demo.
I was going to ask you about the glowing pickle science show.
Yeah.
I mean, if I were a kid and I heard that, I'd be like, sign me up.
I'm like not a kid, and I'm very excited. So Mr. Jason, who had run a really fabulous science after-school program at the Homestead School, is – I don't know how it works. We'll have to see. But there's something about electrodes and glowing pickles and electrolytes, and he's a passionate pickle glowing teacher, and he's going to do a demo probably rolling throughout the afternoon. Whenever we can gather some kids in a corner, I think they're going to see some glowing pickles.
That's going to be an attraction for kids and adults alike. Why do you think something like this is so fun and important? Why does it matter for a small community like Eldred and beyond in the region as well?
You know, I think that these types of events, and it's always been like a hive mind. It's come from lots of different people having ideas and bringing it to the walls of Sullivan Public, like the clothing swap, like these types of activities that we've been honored to host. They're really inclusive. It's free. You can just come. And I feel like everybody can relate to gathering with your neighbors, having an opportunity to spend an afternoon with some people you know, some people you don't. You can bring your friends. You can bring your kids. I think it's really important, especially in like a diffuse rural place, to have like community hubs and you need an excuse to gather sometimes. And so having a celebration of a garden, or whether it's a clothing swap or a garden swap or a holiday event, you know, those types of events draw people from every kind of corner of our neighborhood. It doesn't need to be about buying stuff. It doesn't need to be about making great art. It's just about showing up and gathering. I think that like that in and of itself is really meaningful.
And there's nothing like a glowing pickle to attract folks. Let's remind folks where they can get more information about the pickle party.
So everything's on our website, which is sullivanpublic.com. And everything's on Instagram, which is also at Sullivan Public. It's happening in Eldred, across from PEX, next to the post office, behind the library. That's 16 Proctor Road. It's this Sunday. The whole event is from 10 to 3. The active pickling demonstration part of it is 12 to 2. So, yeah, there should be a whole big span. Hopefully you can come either before, after lunch, or for lunch.
And before we go, anything else coming up that you want to let folks know? Is there a radish rave? a lettuce limbo?
We are going to have a meeting about both of those. Yes, we're doing them both. In the pipeline, yeah, there's always stuff brewing in the pipeline. We're actually really excited. We have a bunch of after-school art classes that we're going to start rolling out for September. And, you know, fall programming is around the corner. So I know it's wild. It's beautiful out right now. Let's focus on the cucumbers.
She's cool as a cucumber. It's Jesse Lazar from Sullivan Public. There's more information about the pickle party and Sullivan Public at sullivanpublic.com. Thank you so much. This sounds so fun.
Thank you for having me.
That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder, you can hear this program and all of our local programs on our website, wjffradio.org. While you're there, take our survey. We're looking for your feedback, especially now that we have been defunded. We're looking for your feedback to tell us how to move forward and keep this vital community resource alive and well. So go to the website, take the survey, turn up the feedback at wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno, and as always, thank you for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Hey, it's Ira Flatow from Science Friday. Public media organizations just lost federal funding, and it is a big deal. This cut will have serious long-term consequences for the service we provide to you unless we replace that funding with support from more listeners. The future of public media is in your hands, so please go to the station's website to start or increase your monthly sustaining donation today. And thanks.
Give now at wjffradio.org.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, former Secretary of State Antony Blinken is not a flamethrower.
Maybe I'm not made for these times.
But he certainly has strong opinions on Israel, Gaza, China, Iran, Russia, Biden and Trump, and the rest of the world.
Left unattended, a problem halfway around the world easily comes and bites us.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. This afternoon at 1 o'clock on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. There is a air quality advisory, an air quality alert that's still in effect as those Canadian wildfires have smoke in our region. When these pollution levels are elevated, the New York State Department of Health recommends individuals consider limiting strenuous outdoor physical activity to reduce the risk of adverse health effects. People who may be especially sensitive to the effects of elevated levels of pollutants include the very young, those with pre-existing respiratory problems such as asthma or heart disease, and those with symptoms should consider consulting their personal physician. Again, an air quality alert in effect for the region at least through midnight tonight, and probably looking at the forecast going to be extended today, sunny to partly cloudy, those areas of smoke reducing visibility at times at a high near 80. Tonight, cloudy, the smoke continues, low 59. Cloudy areas of smoke again, reducing visibility at times with a high around 75. On Point is coming up next from WBUR in Boston.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Grizzly Bagels, small batch handmade New York style bagels in Roscoe, New York. Grizzlybagels.com. and from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
I'm Donna Fellenberg, host of Catskill Character. Join us Saturdays at 10:30 for stories from fascinating characters of the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania, right here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.